Welcome to the Analytics Power Hour. Analytics topics covered conversationally and sometimes with explicit language. Here are your hosts, Mo, Michael, and Tim.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 191. You know, probably there's very few things more disappointing as a people leader when you sit down with someone who's leaving your team or your company and find out they had some dissatisfaction that could have been addressed if only you would have known what their problem was. You know, one very clear learning over the years for me is that people don't always feel comfortable telling you exactly what's bugging them. And even in this area, data can be your friend. Using surveys and other tools to gather feedback is just one tool in the people analytics arsenal. And human resources, departments, and managers everywhere are putting data to work in more and more creative ways to solve employee concerns before they reach a breaking point. Hey, Mo, welcome.
Hi.
You're the marketing data lead at Canva, and I bet some of that resonates with you, too, as a people leader.
It really, really does.
Yeah. And Tim, you're the senior director of analytics at Search Discovery, and I bet some of that resonates with you, but in maybe a different way.
Well, I didn't realize, was I supposed to hold back and be uncomfortable telling people exactly what's bugging me?
No, I am very glad when people tell me. It's the people who don't feel comfortable for whatever reason that...
You just say that because you're not managing me now.
Well, I didn't know how to manage you then either. All right, and I'm Michael Hovling. I'm the managing partner at Stacked Analytics. But obviously, to progress this conversation, we needed a guest. And we want to give a quick shout out and say thank you to listener Matthew Brandt, who was the inspiration behind this episode. Thanks for reaching out and recommending our guest, someone who could fill us in on what's going on in the data space, and that is Andrew Merritt. He is the founder and CEO of Organization View, a pioneering people analytics consulting practice that helps HR become more data-driven. Andrew has held numerous people and human resource leadership roles at companies like UBS, Reuters, and JP Morgan. And today, he is our guest. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Awesome. Well, I think to kick us off, I think just to lay some of the groundwork, I'd love to hear a little bit about the kind of work you do and a little more, you know, some baseline stuff. How did you get into this space, you know, and you know, kind of what's your passion behind it?
So I've been doing people analytics with Organization View since about 2009. These days, we specialize really in projects which involve text or mixed types of data, quite a lot of unstructured data, quite a lot of graph or network-based data. Partly that's because the sort of sophistication of most of our clients has gone up tremendously over the last 10 years. So we always help get called in to help with them with the stuff that they can't do. To give you a very quick summary of how I got to probably being one of the first people doing, you know, data within the HR world, especially here in Europe, I came from a sort of technical background. I had a father in technology. We built a home computer in the 70s from a kit, and I learned to program when I was like 7 or 8 in BASIC on something with like 2.5K. Went off to do maths at university, gave up very quickly and moved to economics because I wanted something more applied. Spent the 90s quite a lot in management consultancy before coming via that route into HR. And I never really was a proper HR person. I was sitting often between marketing and HR and seeing how marketing had developed and how that had gone from, you know, early 90s, where I always used to joke that marketing would seem to be about, you know, working in the morning, going out to lunch with your advertising agency. That was an alcoholic lunch, and you'd come in late, and that was how it is. And moving to the noughties, where, you know, it was very, very data-centric, and I'd always thought, well, you know, I looked at HR and it was rapidly becoming the only part of the business which wasn't bringing numbers to the table in discussions. And I thought, it's an inevitable. It will happen at some stage. Let me use my numbers background and my knowledge of marketing analytics type of techniques to apply into the workforce and to employees. So that's how I got to here. And as I said, we move towards text, which is what we're known for, but we'll often be doing analysis which will include text as just one of the sources within the data. So we tend to have quite a broad approach.
So I do have to say a big thank you to Matthew, firstly, because for those who don't know, I am obsessed with people analytics. It is my favorite topic. And I swear, like, our HR team keep asking me, and one of these days I'm going to say yes to moving to that space. But the thing, Andrew, that I'd be really keen to get your perspective on is just as an industry, it does still kind of, well, the outside perception anyway, and I've been trying to hire a couple of people for some time in this space, it does seem to be a bit younger and less mature maybe than some other more traditional areas of analytics, like definitely recruitment of people in people analytics seems quite tough.
Yeah, I think that's true. The best people I know didn't come from people analytics. They came elsewhere. And I remember when I was learning 15, 18 years ago about how to do this sort of stuff, I had a very, you know, close mentor who was the head of brand research at UBS, a statistician by background. And I would spend a lot of time working with him on there. And I found that that was much more valuable from an HR perspective. When I teach people analytics, I use an old job advert, which I think came from Amazon from way back when, you know, 7, 8 years ago when they were starting. And it was basically saying, you may not have considered a job in people analytics. However, this is a way of applying your, you know, analytic skills elsewhere. I remember, you know, let's say 5, 6 years ago, I had some good acquaintances at Goldman Sachs in their people analytics team. At the time, they had their people analytics on the sort of general analytics sort of community within Goldman's. They had the same pay structure. They were hiring the same sort of people. And the career path was not to be an HR person, but it was a, you know, you were going to be a good analyst in this firm and you'll spend some time doing people analytics. And I think that's the way of getting, certainly on the more technical side, some good people. When I was at UBS and we had it was then called an HR analytics team, I was the only non-psychologist there. And wow. A lot of the good people analytics folks have got a sort of IO psychology background. There's some really good analytics folks in that area. I think the danger potentially is that some of those folks will think that the techniques they learned in IO psychology are the only analytics techniques that we use. And I think we all know that some of the times our best inspirations come from looking at a completely unrelated field and going, oh, that would work really well in my situation. So, yeah, but IO psychology is a big influence in the field, I think.
You said IO psychology? What is I?
Industrial organization psychology.
Okay.
I think that's what Adam Grant studied.
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay. I'm going to go a little even farther back as kind of the total noob or higher level. So where do organizations, you said it's kind of newer space on the...
It feels new to me. That doesn't necessarily mean it's new.
Right. Yeah. So perception, and this is definitely feels new to me, like... I've worked at organizations that have various little tools that do little surveys or little feedback things. And most organizations have some sort of review system. And I assume those are getting logged into some system. But like are there organizations that do no people analytics besides, you know, what our retention is versus ones that are super deep versus in between? Like where's even the awareness like of the field in... And does it vary? I assume large enterprises have long since figured out if they're not doing some people analytics, they're just burning money. But is it moves down market to medium-sized small businesses? Like, where does people analytics happen and happen at robustly?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, even if we take it a bit further back, the history of the field is longer than just psychology. Arguably, a lot of what we would have called and what I studied is operations research, you know, Taylorism about measuring work and seeing how it happens, which is, 100 years old. That has at least as much basis into people analytics today, you know, in terms of at least the problems we're trying to solve. In terms of the firms, what we saw was there was a evolution from the technology and the banking and pharma is another one of a big area for us. The sort of numerical sort of science-led or at least data-led industries started applying people analytics because they applied data to pretty much every one of their problems, and that's where we see it. It is much harder to deal with when you've got a small population size. We don't, most firms aren't recording multiple data points. You know, your HR system has one or two changes a year. So if you've only got 100 people or 150 people, there's not much data you've got. And if you only lose five people a year, you know, how are you going to build an attrition model for that? You know, we've always sort of said, well, as you get smaller or rarer instances, you probably need to go to more towards qualitative data and bring that in. And we're really, really passionate and about sort of a mixed methods type approaches of using data in that way. In the end, we're trying to solve problems, not doing statistical tests or running, you know, machine learning models. So you have to be careful of, you know, can you apply these type of things there? Or you look for instances where there are higher issues. So maybe if you're a smaller firm, you don't look at analyzing the very end of the funnel in terms of who you hire. You might go, okay, well, what could we do to analyze who's applying in the first place? And therefore, we have much bigger data sets and we can solve that problem easier than we can solve the harder problems. You know, when somebody says, how do I identify what makes a great person for the executive team? How many people have you hired for the executive team in the last 10 years, right? How many time instances have you got? There are better ways of trying to solve that problem than trying to look in historical data.
It's interesting you mentioned that because, so we went down this path of trying to hire people in people analytics, and I think there was this really strong preference of like, they had to have HR experience. And I got in this conversation where I was kind of like, I mean, do they really? Because like when I think of people analytics, I do really think about the combination of lots of qual and quant data and definitely like very strong communication skills. Because typically, like, yes, I do think that all data people need strong communication skills, but particularly because this seems to be such an action orientated, business facing, leadership facing type area of the business. Do you feel like finding or like even teaching talent that like quant and qual combination? I feel like with people analytics, like it's such an art form to get it right.
Yeah, it is. And if we look at some of the, you know, one of the pioneers in our area, certainly publicly, was Google, and because who wrote a lot of, you know, a long time ago. I remember chairing a conference where one of their people analytics team were doing it. Well, 2014, 2015. My understanding is that they have a bunch of ex-strategy consultants working at this sort of interface between the client and the data scientists. And that sort of communication is really challenging because you're not just, you know, unlike a very data-rich area, you're not working with data that, you know, has got a huge amount of accuracy in terms of what it is. You're always going to have to be blending different sources in to be able to create a story, especially when, you know, if we look at the, you know, what are we, as an economist, I'd call it a loss function, you know, what's the value if we get this right and what's the cost if we get this wrong, those type of situation. It's super asymmetric. It's probably heavily regulated. So managers need to have really strong confidence. And that's not just a model confidence. That's a, I'm not going to lose my job if I get this decision wrong sort of confidence. So, yeah, the communication skills are hard. In terms of the technical skills, I think it's rare you're going to find somebody with super deep knowledge of HR and super deep technical skills. Maybe that, you know, maybe one of the psychology folk who've come through HR and still have got that background could fit into there. But if I think about my team here, I have a guy who did his PhD in computational physics. I have another one who did a PhD in econometrics, obviously appealed to my biases of what makes a good an analyst. You know, I came into HR relatively late and didn't have a sort of a formal HR training, but I came through organization design and working on consultancy projects around there. So yes, you need to have mental models of what you're analyzing. You need to understand how these things work. But I don't think that means you have to be an HR person to do that. I suspect a lot of managers have good mental models about how an organization works and how people interact in that business.
On the flip side, I mean, the econometrics kind of perspective, which I mean, I think is like an amazing way to approach everything in life. But when it comes to bringing an analytical approach and to the HR team, is there resistance for, are there people in HR who are resistant to the analytics side of things because they have a perception that, oh, you're trying to boil things down to hard numbers and this is a softer skill? Like, is there resistance in HR teams sometimes to the analytics side of things, or are they usually saying, I'll take whatever I can get?
No, I think that goes two ways. I see more resistance 5 years ago than I see now. Nowadays in organizations, it's almost the opposite. They want to use AI to solve every single problem. And I go, okay, like, don't use it for this situation. You know, do get somebody to just do this humanly, because, you know, it'll take you so much more time to build a model than it will be to, you know, just to pay some, you know, a junior person to just do the job manually. We used to see quite a lot of resistance and people not doing it. I think it comes back to those communication skills. You need to know what the data can do and you need to know what it can't do. And it's that balance between, you know, wanting to use it in a smart way and overusing the data. And I think that's the challenge that we have. And, you know, if I think about the sort of the data that was coming off my colleague's experiments in computational physics, his level of accuracy and measurement is a, you know, completely the opposite end than our measurement acumen. So you need to be able to think about the data and how it's been captured and what it actually does say, and it's importantly what it doesn't say. And yeah, it's a blending sort of thing. So I don't think you can necessarily run it there. In terms of the econometrics part, the one thing that I mean, there's two parts on econometrics. There is a obscure little part of economics called personnel economics, and there's some really good work in academic work in there, especially around things like game theory and how, you know, promotions are done in terms of games and stuff like that. I look at that, you know, as somebody who's interested in the field. Also, econometrics is...
I feel like managing through the prisoner's dilemma seems like the perfect way.
Yeah, you should get everyone to do, you know, game theory as way of managing. The other thing that I found interesting about econometrics is that economists often deal with found data, right? So psychologists will often be creating experiments and doing things in a sort of controlled manner, whereas econometricians will often get given a data set and say, you know, analyze this, and we're looking for different things such as, you know, natural experiments and stuff like that. So yeah, it's useful to have it, but as I said, you want to get as many different types of people into your analytics team, because they all come with a different set of lenses, and therefore when you then combine them together, you get really, really interesting results.
So here's then my fundamental, if we look at just like text analytics and NLP, and as you were just saying, there's found data and there's kind of gathered data. So we all get told like, hey, you work at the company, your emails, your Slack messages, all those are technically fair game. When we're thinking people analytics and analysis, does it fall into that ever, into a, we're going to cull through the stuff that we legally and have a right to go through of found data, of, or is it typically really limited to, this is survey data, this is data that we did collect either through an experiment or through a survey where we were informing the employees, or is it not black and white? Do you not go there? Is that a no, people analytics in general, unless there's a...
Judging by people's faces right now, Tim, this feels like a weird area.
I think it is, but you just kind of, when you're like, oh, found data, I'm like, well, okay, there's a big data set. I I feel like I want to ask it.
Yeah, I think when I was thinking of found data, I'd be thinking about, you know, events in an HR system about somebody changing jobs where that system was never designed to,
okay,
to capture data. In terms of the sort of data that you mentioned, yes, there's a lot of conversations in the sphere about that. I think there's two issues. One, we're in a space where we have to be really ethically strong. And just because you're legally responsible for doing it doesn't mean you should do it. I've always said to clients and to my team, you know, unless you can stare the employees in the eye and say, this is why you'll benefit from us doing this analysis, we shouldn't be doing that sort of type of data, right? And some of that might be hard. You know, if you're doing an analysis to work out, you know, help somebody support a redundancy program, arguably the people who are going to lose their job aren't right. But if the alternative is that you do a random sample, or as is usually the case, who shouts loudest keeps the job, you know, arguably you're doing people better by taking a more objective aspect. I think there's another aspect there in terms of the quality of data. If I ask a text question such as, could we do to improve customer experience? We'll get really good quality data about customer experience and ideas for improving customer experience. If I go and scrape the internal Slack, I'll get such noisy data. And yeah, I might find some interesting stuff, but our job's not about, you know, I don't have the time or the money, and clients don't pay me to just go and find interesting stuff. They want a business problem solving. And if we can go and ask somebody specifically, how would you fix this, and ask 30,000 people that, and get the whole perspectives from around the world, you get a lot richer data because you can analyze it in the context, the text in the context of what's being asked. And especially on the ambiguous statements, that context is really, really important.
So I just want to, I'm not saying I think this will be a good idea. I want to make sure I'm closing the loop a little bit and saying I could see, because there's precedent for anonymizing data. I mean, that was a super helpful, that's kind of what I suspected the answer was. I could see organizations saying, we're taking your message, we're separating it from you, we're taking steps to make sure that names are scrubbed, and then we're just, you know, we've rolled out a new process and we just wanted to cull through it. I do feel like where you hit on at the end was like, that's so noisy that you're gonna, the signal versus noise in that probably just isn't worth it. That feels like the sort of thing that somebody in a management position would think that the magic of AI would purely find some golden nugget. And really that's like chasing after something you're not going to find. So, okay.
It's like when they want to digest your Twitter feeds and your Facebook posts, yeah, and stuff like that. And it's like, what does that have to do with anything?
I think the thing is though, Tim, that when I think of what our people team have in terms of data requests, the truth is they're actually swimming in data. Like, of any area of the business, they are the ones that have so much and don't necessarily have the resources to do anything that you're like, even if you could do something like that, and even if you could find value in it, I'm like you think of like applications that you get, like who you actually, like your whole hiring pipeline of what applications you get through to interviews, through to actually getting a job, through to who's successful in the job, who actually becomes high performing. What does that mean about your referrers? That's like just one tip of the iceberg of like the hiring process. And then you talk about engagement, you talk about retention, like what's going to keep staff. Like, I mean, there are just so many ways you can go that I'm like, why would I want to analyze people's Slack messages?
Yeah. So, and again, I mean, I was asking for,
I wasn't promoting it
or thinking it was happening, but when you say swimming in data, so come from the higher point forward outside of data that you like, they're swimming in data. Like, I mean, get that there's over time, there's promotions. So like what are the, and there's review, like what's the data they're swimming in that happens to them versus their collect, I guess, what is the data you're working with?
So that I think you can go in most of the people analytic applications, you can go from starting with a core, which is usually a human resources system, which records who's in each role, what are their career histories been, some demographic information about that individual. That's usually the starting place for people when they're really, really starting out. And they'll do stuff as early pilots, such as attrition analysis, seeing if they can spot any patterns for why people are leaving the organization just from there. Then you start looking at other human resources systems, such as talent management systems, about the reviews and the whole performance management process. That's usually in a different system. There's a recruitment system. That's usually a different system. The recruitment system is a really interesting one, actually, because a lot of people, there's a lot of data for a lot of firms. You're getting a large number of applications there. When I used to look after recruitment strategy at UBS, I think we got something like somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million applications a year. So, you know, there's a vast quantity of data. What's interesting, if you think about the data, though, is you only record people who are successful at any stage. So you don't know that that person that you never bothered taking to interview wasn't the perfect person and would be in your high flyer. You can't possibly know that. You haven't got any data. So people get a bit blinded and thinking, oh, I'll just analyze this thing. But your data is a creation of the processes you're usually trying to analyze. And you, by the fact that you're managing them and making decisions along the way, that you're also biasing the data as part of that. So you often have to have a think about those type of aspects as well. I don't think enough analysts do think about that.
Of all of the white dudes we hired, yeah, which was mostly what we hired, yeah, the white dudes were most successful, therefore white dudes must be the, yeah.
Yeah.
But can I ask about that, speaking of demographics, like one thing that has sort of surprised me and I've kind of reflected on, so we do annual culture surveys, which is, you know, employee satisfaction, very typical, lots of different quant questions with opportunities for comments. And the bit that always surprises me is how much the business wants to understand the results from a demographic perspective. And the reason I find that really surprising is because in marketing analytics, like, yes, we can cut data by demographics. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. That's a long-winded rabbit hole I won't go down. But I feel like generally we have shifted our thinking that behavioral data is actually more important. But when it comes to people analytics, and I don't, in my head, I can't wrap my head around, is it because we're trying to figure out if there's a specific group of people that we're either discriminating against, that we're not treating fairly, that we're not giving enough opportunity? Like, is that what's driving people to want to see that demographic breakdown? Or is it that maybe their understanding is more limited and therefore we don't have those behavioral cues? Or like, it's a question that keeps coming back in my mind that I haven't found an answer to.
I think it's predominantly the latter. I think the way that we'd usually be analyzing data from a sort of reporting perspective, which companies have done for many, many years, is by splitting on this sort of demographic data because it's easy to get access to. It also can be mistreated. So, for example, we did a piece of work with a financial services firm in Asia late last year, and in a country where they were legally allowed to, the recruitment team decided they were going to hire people over the age of 35 because people over the age of 35 left less than people under there. But that was also significantly because people over the age of 35 had 10 years tenure. And we know that the probability of leaving drops every single year. So if we then cut it and said, instead of analyzing how old they were when they left, we analyzed how old they were when they joined, which is something you can control, and they were trying to control, you know, is there a difference there? And the difference disappeared overnight. So you suddenly find that a lot of these demographics, you're looking at something completely different, and there's a sort of confounder that you haven't been thinking about that's really, really the challenge there. I prefer having a look at behaviors. There are some demographics that do make a difference. Gender has more issue than I'd like it to have in so many different ways. But often it's not just gender, but it's other things linked to there. I think it's right to understand things from sort of gender and other protected clauses, just to make sure, not to see how people are getting less promotion, but then to ask the question, why is that happening? And to really study that. Tenure, as I said, is always an important one to look at. Management grade is all important. The analysts tend to sit in headquarters. They tend to be medium to senior level. You know, if you're the person working in the warehouse, moving boxes around, how the organization looks to you is very different to somebody in headquarters. And it's worth addressing that. And an executive will never hear those voices unless we work out a way of doing that.
So you've sort of said that collecting the text or the qualitative data around, and I think you said it's around kind of employee experience or employee satisfaction. Like what is kind of the mechanism? I mean, to kind of combine that with sort of where we were with demographics, what is kind of the mental model or sort of the framing of, you're trying to ask the right questions, get sort of opened in feedback. I think I saw in one of your talks somewhere, you're like, look, asking one question and getting one open in question is going to give you richer information than asking a bunch of, you know, drop down selects. So is that kind of the nature of get them talking in their words? Data's messier but more valuable. And then kind of combining with that, are you slicing it basically whether warehouse worker versus executive, but are you also slicing by race and gender and other factors? Like, how do you actually analyze that?
Yeah, let me start from the sort of beginning. I think if we were to ask I think it's worth having a think about the survey and the survey, what it does. So a traditional survey, when you've got, let's say, 50 employee questions and maybe a couple of open text questions, if you're lucky, that they've tacked on at the edge, probably without much thought about how they'll do it. Usually, you know, some of the big providers I know have...
Anything else you'd like to say?
But yeah, precisely. All right, so the scale questions are based on some form of model of what they want to understand about. It's often from an engagement perspective, it's some hopefully carefully validated studies that a bunch of psychologists have done.
Are those the ones like the, do you have a best friend at work? That was a Gallup or somebody came.
What? I thought it was like, I'm proud to work at this company. Was like
that was, yeah, that. But both of them have gone through the same sort of process, right? So the way I look at it in terms of the open and the scale is that the scale questions have come with a model first. You have a model of what you want to understand. You ask about those things and you get a ratings. The open text, you develop your model when you see your data, right? So certainly we do, you know, have taken a very much inductive type of approach of what's in here, and then you often find that employees talk about something that you'd have never asked about in an employee survey, right? And I think that's a really interesting...
What's an example of a prompt that would drive something? Like, how do you... What kind of prompt is what drives those sorts of responses?
We always recommend people ask questions in pairs on open text. We say, what's great about working for this organization? And what would you do to improve working at this organization? The reason we ask in pairs is that sentiment analysis is really inaccurate, especially on survey data. So it's quite hard to work out whether this person's really saying this is a positive way and really negative, especially because a lot of those answers are super ambiguous, right? So, you know, I give a bunch of people the same responses and get them to rate it, they'll rate it differently. And this is just there. So asking in a pair, whether it's about working at the firm or over the last 2 years, we've done a lot of, you know, working from home. How could we, you know, what's good about working from home? What could we do to help make it easier for you or make it more valuable? You need to keep it open enough that people feel that they can write stuff in without having to just sort of leading them in, but not so open like, is there anything else you want to tell us? Where that generally prompts people to be sarcastic and jokey and not give you any serious responses. And we've seen them all.
That's Tim.
So we then get the comments, and let's say it's 30, 50, 100,000 responses because our clients are on the sort of larger scale. We will pre-process this and use automated translation. We find that's good enough for understanding the responses, but it's not good enough to translate the questions because you need the granularity in a human being to do that. We will then go through a text analysis process. And as I said, it's for us, it used to be 100% inductive. These days it's a hybrid, so we've got a standard model and training data of somewhere in the region of 230 themes that people talk about in sort of open questions, and then we'll look at the remaining data and so say, are there other themes that we haven't got in this data set because it's client specific or it's industry specific? So we look at it there, and then we analyze every single one of those themes by those categories. We like using binary classification models, so we'll build 230 binary classification models. Is this about training or isn't it about training? We find that a lot more accurate than doing a multi-label model. We then take each category and we look at how people are describing about it. So how are they describing leadership? What are the different ways? I was just explained just before this call about doing this, explaining the results we'd had with a client. We had the clusters had identified that a bunch of people were talking about too many leadership changes. And then another bunch of people were talking about how leadership needed to change. And the clustering has split those two things out. And they're completely different, but the words are pretty much identical, just in different orders. So we then get a much bigger list. Now, I think you can get it from employee survey to there without what we'd call an exam question. But you need to have some specific things about what you're trying to get out of that. You know, if we had the head of IT asking us, what do we need to know about this survey? It's not just the time people mention technology. He or she probably needs to know about the time they don't mention technology, but you'd have thought they would. So we were doing a lot of manual paperwork. The head of IT wants to know about areas where doing lots of manual paperwork. So we get it to that sort of level, and then we do an sort of exploratory find and say, are any of these topics or subclusters more likely to be mentioned by a particular group than others? And we have a sort of a probabilistic model that goes through all of this demographic and say, you know, people are talking about, well, I'll give you a real example from last week. If you were a junior person, you talk about career development in terms of training and learning new skills. As you go up more senior in the organization, it starts to become about navigating the organization, about the politics, about open opportunities, about how can we have gone fully working at home over the last 2 years, but you still need to relocate to Cambridge to do a particular type of job, right? So you start to see the nuance in this sort of data, but to get good communication, to get good reports, and therefore to take action, you need to have a really strong exam question of what am I trying to answer? And you could have the same data set answering a bunch of different questions. But yeah, you have to be happy that you only use a subset of that data to answer a particular type of question, because a lot of it just won't be relevant to the question you're trying to answer. And I think that's those sort of challenges that we've been working really, really closely with a really great, somebody teaches academics how to do qualitative research. And I've just been saying, look, we can get the technology to understand and split up this stuff, but it's, you know, everybody's just going, so what? So we've just been sort of saying, how would you do this manually if somebody gave you this as an unlimited budget? Now let's see how we can automate the parts that would be deadly boring for you to do this. And you can't do everything completely automated.
You're completely blowing my mind, because I suppose the thing is, like I've done a lot of survey stuff in my career, and one of the things, I'm not going to lie, I always lead towards quant stuff just because it's easier to work with. And then you have a number and you can look at that number last year versus this year and break it down multiple ways. And as soon as you start getting into open text, I'm like, this shit's hard. NLP is hard. And one of my biggest frustrations is, like, you always end up with some like word cloud that someone then is like, but how many people does that affect? And you go, good question. I have no freaking idea, because all I've got is a bunch of words and they don't tell me, like, anyway, I am like mind blown by this whole process. And it's obviously you're doing completely incredible work. And I'm so fascinated. This is amazing.
I think one of the fascinations on the core side for me, because I was very much a quant person at the beginning, was doing this sort of marketing HR stuff back in the day, and doing usability tests. And we used to usability test all of our HR systems, which was frankly, you know, I still have great fun, but And you'd produce all of this sort of web reports of how they were using your career site and how they're using the tools. And then you'd show one video of somebody struggling and not being able to, you know, how on earth do I just apply for this role? And you show that video to the executives and suddenly you get your budget, right? And you can produce as many numbers as you want, but it's the quality stuff that has power. And if you get the, if, you know, we look at trying to identify those sort of quotes as well, because we know that if you're building a story, we can sort of quantify how, you know, the split of people talking about leadership, how they using it in different clusters, but actually also finding the sort of needle in the haystack of a really well, powerfully written quote. We go, this is explains what this, these group of people are going through. That, that's important. But you can't fully automate it. You have to use the human who ends up pulling all this data together, but we just hope we can sort of quantify and give a sort of scale and be able to say, you know, this is an issue in France, but it's not at all an issue in the States, or, you know, these are the sort of things that people at headquarters are talking about. So we had a wonderful example with a sportswear company where the sales teams thought that the product teams weren't listening, they should spend more time with the customers. And the product team did thought that they were, because they weren't getting the right products, and the product team saying, "One elf, aren't these salespeople developing, you know, selling our products, because we're, you know, we've been developing them like crazy, and they're really, we think they're really fantastic." And you see the same sort of, you know, they're both talking about the products, but they're completely different, different ways of using those sort of themes. So we see that time and time again within that sort of information.
Let's step aside for a brief word about our sponsor, ObservePoint. I mean, sure, you could just have some poor intern or junior analyst click around your entire website every couple of days with developer tools open, looking for missing or misfiring tags, but that would be pretty brutal.
Definitely. Downright cruel, actually. Not only would it be prone to error, but if you've got even the most basic level of people analytics going on in your organization, they would definitely throw a red flag when it comes to the job satisfaction of those poor souls. Much better to automate a task like that.
And luckily, automation is what ObservePoint does best. It automates the ongoing monitoring of your website for data collection issues.
Automation for the win! ObservePoint doesn't remove the need for people, it just removes the drudgery of constantly monitoring key pages and user paths for proper and privacy-compliant data collection. People need to set up the auditing, of course, and people need to be recipients of automated alerts when something goes wrong. But let's let the machines do the repetitive stuff. That's where ObservePoint shines.
And, of course, it's human beings who will need to look at the reports that trend the results of the auditing over time so that they can see if their data governance and QA processes are really working well.
Exactly. I mean, basically, ObservePoint not only helps ensure the integrity of your data collection, it reduces the risk that your people analytics will turn up repetitive data auditing as a driver of employee dissatisfaction. So if you want to learn more about ObservePoint's many capabilities, go request a demo at ObservePoint.com/analytics power hour and give your junior analyst a break. Let's get back to the show.
So switching gears just a little, or not, maybe not really switching gears, like obviously your work probably tends to work with like pretty large organizations to kind of do this. Smaller companies, like you said earlier, you can't really do this with their data, but there are companies that sort of do aggregates, like they'll do in surveys and then aggregate your results up into their, all their customers. Could you talk a little bit about your perspective about, are those useful? Have you found them to be useful for smaller companies, or is it just sort of like, well, how do you know?
Yeah, I think there's it's mixed. I think sometimes the survey providers try and persuade people that benchmark data is a lot more valuable than it is, because it,
well, of right? course, because that's right, what you're right? paying
and,
for.
And, yeah. but, and it's yeah. and it's context free, right? So you can't mm-hmm. you can't look at those answers and assume that they're the same sort of thing. We've done quite a lot of work in saying we can predict survey answers from the population that give it, because they obviously have different needs, different life stages. If you have a group of people who have just joined, they'll tend to be really happy about the firm because they're in a honeymoon phase. If you've got a team that's full of eight people who've been 8 years within the firm and they're all a cynical bunch, they'll just naturally have a much lower score, and you just have to accept that. You know, you're not looking, you're not comparing apples with apples.
I was briefly imagining having a team of 8-year-olds.
Sometimes I think that would benefit. The US-based firm ADP runs payroll for a large percentage of the US population, and their aggregate data is phenomenal. And certainly they publish job reports, and they're more accurate in some ways than the official statistics because they just have such a big sort of item level data set there. So I think it's mixed. There are things that you can do with sort of people analytics type techniques that can do in smaller organizations. One thing that we've been doing a lot of, and I think it's not just us, I think a lot of people are doing it at the moment, is what's called organization network analysis. And there are two different ways of collecting the data there. I mean, the gold standard is probably both. One is you can look at communication flows, and you know, you can get the metadata out of your email system, or you know, Microsoft have got a tool that enables you to do this automatically. The other way is you can ask survey data. The automated way will have a much more complete record of the communication, as long as that communication was via electronics. If it was about two people physically talking to each other, it won't have any record of that whatsoever. That data doesn't tell you the quality of that conversation. The survey data will talk about the quality of the relationships, but it won't talk about, you know, people will have their normal human biases, probably recency and all those type of things. So the idea is to bring it together. But I think, you know, I prefer the survey basis because also from a legal perspective, it's usually a lot easier to get through an organization to get it done because you're asking people and they can choose not to provide information. We probably can deal with that for a nice use case from 150 people, you get some reasonably interest. And then you use that data like you do in a social network analysis and start to analyze relationships between people within firms. And this comes onto a conversation which I think, you know, we've looked at before, which is around collaboration and actually what is performance. And I think this is something that's starting to come into the field. Traditionally, people had a performance review and the HR system was designed to say, Tim or Michael or Mo, this is your rating over the last year. This is how you did. And in some ways, if we think about the data, it's a sort of, you could sort of say, well, this is assuming that everybody's individual based and that the way that you work together as a team is irrelevant. But and the sort of networking type approach is putting much more emphasis into understanding how those relationships happen. And I've certainly seen instances where a team of high performers, you know, they had an admin person in the team and none of them would have been high performing if you took that admin person out of the team. Because
that's fantastic.
Yeah. So you look at constructing teams, and I think some of the stuff that, you know, if you look at sports and how, you know, we all know in whatever our favorite sport is, you get some huge superstar moving teams and suddenly they go from high performer to not high performer. There's a book, I think I'm going to get this right, I'll send you guys the link so you can put it in the show notes, called Boris Weinberg, I think, about where they studied equity analysts. And equity analysts were an interesting study group because they all rate each other, and that's public data. So that across firms there. And one of the findings was if a superstar analyst moves from, let's say, JP Morgan to Goldman's, there's a probability that he or she will be a success in the new environment, right? And what would change that success? Well, recruiting the whole team increases the likelihoods because you keep that sort of social glue together. That makes more. Women are more likely to be successful in that environment than men because women tend to bring networks broader and often outside the firm, where men rely on people within the firm and closer. So it's fascinating being able to have a look at some of these stuff as performance, as a measure of collaboration. You know, we've always said we want you to collaborate. And then we always measure people as individuals, right? So,
yeah. Oh, my. You just picked on a scar that needs a whole other episode. That's so good.
Oh, my God. This is perfect. I'm actually doing my performance reviews later tonight. So, like, yes, this is such a good... good thing to get the mind going.
So I just want to close the loop. So with the whole network piece and the communication, so that is like dipping the toe into the pulling data from the email system, but just at the communication flow, does that tend to anonymize the person if you're trying to find sort of the communication networks and nodes? It just doesn't have the content of the communication.
It doesn't have the content of the communication, but there's still some really useful stuff you can do. You can see when people are getting messages. So you can see things like who's sending out lots of stuff at the weekend and when you start joining that to engagement data, do people whose boss send the messages on Saturday night, are they as engaged as people who, you know, are expected to have a more normal work life with a separation there? So we can start measuring those. Or you can spot teams where, and I've been in some of these environments, where everybody CCs their boss on every single thing.
Oh,
it's a big red flag.
Yeah, you can see that sort of stuff in the data. So you don't need to see what it is, but you can't tell whether the message is, you know, shall we go for lunch today, or can we deliver this project because you're late? That's the sort of thing you don't get on the email. And I would really, you know, if a client asked us anything about reading text on emails, we would just say, no.
Yeah,
no, don't go there.
That's right.
Yeah.
Can I ask you an odd question, Andrew?
Oh, Mo, you're killing me right now.
Oh, come on. This is like my favorite topic.
Okay. No, I know. And this is your last one, Mo.
Okay, it's my last question. So I was chatting to a psychologist from an employee satisfaction survey tool thing. And we were talking about like the general questions that we touched on, or statements that people typically score, like, I'm proud to work here, or I see myself working here in 5 years' time, general indicators of engagement or whatnot. And one of the things he said that was really interesting is that previously the topic of systems and processes didn't have a big impact on employee engagement or retention. But since COVID happened and like the change of how companies work now and people working from home and yada, 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 systems and processes seems to be this area that if people are not happy in that space, that does seem to be correlated, I'll use that word lightly, with lower engagement or retention. I'm just curious, like, have you seen in your work any sort of shifts in trends or like things that have changed as a result of the different ways that we're all working now?
I'm going to answer that in two parts, because I think that what we're seeing in terms of the systems and processes is almost completely different. So if you ask somebody what's great about working here, what's not great working here, the really engaged people talk about systems as processes as needing improving. Basically, if you're asking open text. So if you're asking open text, a really engaged employee will talk about things that get in the way of them performing. They'll talk about bureaucracy. They'll talk about speed. They'll talk about decision making. They'll talk about tools. As you look at disengaged people, they talk about bullying and a whole range of different things. Talking to the HR department is definitely linked to being disengaged. And likewise, if you look at the positive things, a engaged person will talk about the vision and buying into the vision or the mission of there, about working with the organization, whereas disengaged people will talk about, well, I get paid a lot and it's nice, it's not far from my home. So it's different in there. In terms of the other part of, have we seen any difference within there? I think it's changing so frequently, and it changes depending on the firm. Certainly, people want more flexibility, but that's always been the case. Flexibility has been a big, big issue. When we started in sort of COVID 2 years ago, we moved flexibility, working from home, from flexibility, we had it in a category that we'd tend to assign them together, to to its own category. But it's now they're seeing there, you see different patterns depending on the group of people within the audience. And Actually, I looked yesterday at one of our clients. The closest thing, and this, I say one of our clients, it could have been any of our clients. The closest top theme that we have linking to working at home is micromanagement.
As in people are getting more micromanaged because of working from home. Wow.
Not in terms of the absolute amount, but when we look at sort of probabilistic, which ones are really unusually likely to link together, you know, which are coming together much more than you would expect, micromanagement is the number one. So we're seeing those two sort of themes coming up time and time again. But it really depends on the organization. I've got clients who wanted, the exec team wanted to everybody to be in the office for the last 2 years, and this has been a battle between them and the employees. We find that, you know, with people saying, we're growing so much as a business, we're totally overcrowded. You know, why are we having everyone in the office if we're going to all get it because the office is overcrowded? Or we've seen people, firms, cutting down time when the canteen's open. So then everyone's going, you know, we're trying to stay safe, but we used to have the canteen open 2 hours. Mm. It's now 1 hour. And that means it's twice as busy as it used to be. So we're seeing all those type of patterns. So, yeah, the tools and technology, I think people have relied more on tools and technology. It was a big theme at the beginning of COVID when I think most firms did amazing jobs of getting people up and running at home, and, you know, quicker than they ever could have imagined, especially in places like India where they had to physically think, you know, they're unlikely to have broadband and kit at home and stuff like that. I think the vast majority of our clients have done amazingly well. But people are now saying stuff like, you know, why should I have to relocate because I've been able to do this job from, you know, wherever for the last few years? Why do I now have to move me and my family halfway around the country to be able to do that?
All right, it's time for the Conductrix Quiz, the quizzical query that presents a conundrum to my two co-hosts as they go toe-to-toe on behalf of two listeners. All right, Tim and Mo, are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Excellent.
Ditto.
We're tied on the answer
to that question.
The Analytics Power Hour and the Conductrix Quiz are sponsored by Conductrix. Conductrix builds industry-leading experimentation software for A/B testing, adaptive optimization, and predictive targeting. Go check them out at conductrix.com for more information on how they can help you. All right, Mo, are you ready? You are competing for our very good friend of the show, Robert Petkovich.
Yes! Hey, Robert.
Whoa.
Yes. And Tim, you are competing for our listener, Adam Woodhouse.
Excellent.
Very cool. All right, here we go. Here's the quiz. The Power Hour gang is getting prepped for their next guest. But before the guest pops on, Michael mentions to the team, hey, I've got a question. I have sales data for a product that doesn't have a demand that varies over time. However, the demand does differ by geographic regions, and I calculated a mean sales value for each geography. I know these are just samples, so I wanted to give the client a measure of uncertainty around them as estimates of the true expected sales in those regions. I thought I would use the standard error, but I noticed that in geos with very large outliers, the standard error is huge. I noticed that in the calculation of the standard error, after we subtract each data element's value by the mean, we then square all of those mean subtracted values before we sum them up. The squaring has the effect of more heavily weighting the outlier observations in our standard error calculation. So, as to not have the outliers have such a huge impact, I removed the square terms and just added all the differences up. But I must be doing something wrong because I'm now seeing A, the Helms error measure is now larger in the geos with outliers, or B, the Helms error measure is now larger in the geos without outliers. C, the Helms error measurement is infinity for all the geos. D, the error measurement is zero for all the geos. Or E, the error measure is now larger in geos with a larger number of sales values that are greater than zero but less than one.
I would say repeat the question, but I don't want to subject any of our listeners to that.
I'm really interested in the answer, though.
It's a Gordian knot for sure.
I'm like, this is where median absolute deviation, MAD, would be awesome. I think I just got so excited that would be the, and that's not at all the.
That's not what I'm seeing. Yeah.
Oh my God. He removed the outlier. Okay. Good Lord. Well, who's starting?
Oh, I was very confident about removing one. And now I'm thinking of something that always happens in R, and I'm like, maybe I shouldn't remove that one.
Interesting.
Well, maybe I'll start, and I'm going to say I'm going to eliminate the last one because it was like the longest and most detailed and wasn't paired with something else. And so even though that just seems, I'm going to remove
remove E. Error measure is now larger in geos with a larger number of sales values that are greater than zero but less than one. That was a great choice. It was a mouthful. Definitely it's out of here. So now we just have A, B, C, and D.
Okay. I have got two guesses to what it is. So I'm going to try and eliminate one of the other two.
Okay.
Which is D, the Helbs error measurement is zero for all the geos.
You want to eliminate that one?
Yes, but now you're making me question myself.
This is like a wait, don't tell me.
I just wanted to be clear. I just wanted to be super clear. That's what you wanted to do. All right, so we'll go ahead and eliminate D. And bum, bum, bum. Unfortunately, that is the correct answer. Error measurement is zero for all the geos. I'm so sorry.
I'm literally going to go back and listen to this quiz again.
Me too.
I may actually
removed the outliers, and now the error measurement is zero. That's interesting.
Yeah, so here's the answer. The average difference between each element and the mean is zero. If we multiply the mean sales values by the total number of records, it will equal the value of total sales. Since we're subtracting out the mean from each element, it stands to reason we're removing the total sales value from the data, so its mean of the updated data after we remove the mean for each element should now be zero. It starts to be clear once you play around with a simple data set. If you want to use a measurement of loss that is robust to outliers, you could use measures like the mean absolute error or the Huber loss, which is a combination of the quadratic and mean absolute errors.
I still think MAD is an option, median absolute deviation. Well, but now I do want a sample data set created to fiddle around with this one.
I'm pretty sure Kirchhoff will do that.
I'm pretty sure he actually already included one.
Oh, stop it.
No, but I wasn't allowed to give it to you. He did actually create one. Oh, it's not going to come through there. I have to find something to show it to you.
I'll call an audible. We will post this data set in the show notes for this episode if you would like to go and play around with this.
If you would like to, yes. All right. So that means, Adam Woodhouse, you're a winner. Tim, great job. Robert, we're so sorry. But, such is life. All right. Thanks once again to Conductrix for being a sponsor and another awesome Conductrix quiz. Let's get back to the show. Okay. This time we're definitely going to start to wrap up because, that's what the employee survey says we have to do. No, I'm just kidding. All right. Awesome conversation. Awesome. Thank you so much, Andrew. It's phenomenal. All right. One thing we do love to do is sort of go around the horn and share a last call, something of interest to our listeners. Maybe we could share. Andrew, you're our guest. Do you have a last call you'd like to share?
Yeah, I was having a think about this. I'm very fortunate in that my wife gave up corporate life and went to run a bookshop locally because she was distraught that it was going to go out of business. So I have access to a bookshop, which is nice. It's nice, but it's really dangerous. Right. And
You don't get a discount?
I get a discount. My mental model is that means I can buy more books, right? So
yeah.
So I buy a lot. I read a subset of that. One that I really enjoyed last year, which is probably about 12 months old now, is a book called The Great Demographic Reversal by Charles Goodhart and I believe Manoj Pradhan. It's a book that it's a macroeconomic sort of book and looking at the changes in demographics in our society. One of the big things is that they argue that there's a whole bunch of implications, including higher inflation, as a natural consequence of having increasing number of retired folks in society and folks who aren't working compared to those who do. So I just found it complete mind opener. It was an easy read. Charles Goodhart especially is well known in the economics fade. I think Manoj was head economist at one of the big banks. So they've got some good stories, and certainly as a different way of thinking about our societies, it was good. And it survives COVID, if that makes any sense, right? So some of the numbers might be different now, but the general themes, I think, are the same sort of thing. So I enjoyed that.
Outstanding. Okay, Tim, what about you?
So I'm going to go with back when we had Cassie Kozarkov on, the part 4 of her Making Friends with Machine Learning series was about to come out. And then it subsequently came out, and I subsequently had it on my to-do list for several months. But I did finally get down to watching the part 4 of Making Friends with Machine Learning. And it was like an hour and a half, and it was really good. It's the one where she runs through kind of a quick survey and explanation of k-means and k-nearest neighbors and classification and support vector machines. So as I recall, in parts 1 through 3, was very dismissive of part 4 and the specific models. But as much as I find myself kind of hearkening back to things from those earlier parts as I've marinated on them, I was happy to get through part 4, and I do recommend it. I recommend the entire series, even though it's a multi-hour commitment, but it's free and it's on YouTube, and it's Cassie, who's just delightful.
I was about to say, oh my God, Tim, I'm so surprised you didn't describe part 4 as delightful. And there she rolls.
It's just so fun to watch somebody that smart explain stuff that clearly. Yeah.
We definitely make sure that gets into the sentiment analysis. All right, Mo, what about you? What's your last call?
I've got a twofer because one I've already done before, but given today's show, I'm going to revisit it. And the other one is just a fun one. So firstly, if you've enjoyed today's conversation, I really encourage you to read Work Rules by Laszlo Bock, who led Google's People Analytics team. I mean, they go like extreme about like measuring whether people will eat less food if you have smaller plates and all sorts of stuff. Like, it really goes next level. But it is just a really fascinating read about like how deep people analytics can go. And it's just fascinating and a fun read.
And they haven't had an employee walkout in like a few years. So that's
okay.
Good.
Oh, geez. But it's what got me really interested in the topic in the first place, I think. Anyway, the other thing I wanted to do is just do a shout out to Rachel Gearson. Because
speaking of Google, right?
Oh, yeah. I was like, what did I do wrong? You were giving me a strange look.
No, okay, that makes sense. She's a Google, right?
Yeah. Yes, she's a Google. But she posted a bunch of data memes the other day, and it just made me really happy. So if you just are not good at jokes like me and you want to give your team a laugh on Monday morning, check out Data Science Dojo on Instagram and look at the data science one-liners. Like, you could even just have them up your sleeve for when you need like a good data joke. It's just like light and harmless, and it was fun. Made me smile.
Very nice.
What about you, Michael?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So at Super Week this year, David Vallejo demoed a tool that he had built, and it's still kind of in beta, but I really was blown away by it. So if you live in the world of data implementation, especially in mobile apps, doing debugging of Google Analytics specifically is really annoying and hard to do. And he's built this amazing tool to be able to do that. And so I would suggest checking it out. I thought it is, well, it's kind of a labor of love on his part, but he's building such a great tool for the community. And if you do have anything to do with sort of implementation, it's an Android debugger for GA, really Google Analytics related things. So a little bit specific, but there's plenty of people in our listener base who are having to deal with that and don't have great tools to help. All right. Well, I'm sure as you've been listening, you've been getting some ideas or thoughts, and we'd love to hear from you. The best way to do that is through the Measure Slack group or on Twitter, or you can also email us at contact@analyticshour.io. Andrew, I don't know, do you do much in the social media realm? If people wanted to reach out, maybe they could reach out via LinkedIn or something like that.
It always falls down during work times, and we're super, super, super
totally super understandable.
So LinkedIn is best. And Yeah, I'm the only Andrew Mout, I think, or one of the only Andrew Mouts there. Certainly the only one there. So
yeah.
You can find it.
And Organization View is the name of the company. So, yeah, I think, you know, people might want to reach out and get some more information as well. And, you know, so we want to make that available. Andrew, once again, very stimulating conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Really appreciate it.
I've had a great time. Thank you.
Awesome. And we also want to thank our producer, Josh Crowhurst, who does so much behind the scenes to make this show possible. So, Josh, thank you for all of your excellent work. And thanks to our listeners. In this case, you know, Matthew Brandt, thank you so much for the suggestion. We really appreciate it. And if you've got suggestions as a listener, we'd really love to hear them. It turns out pretty good sometimes. Really good. Really good. In this case,
we'll provide Matthew with that feedback. That's right.
Yeah. And obviously, we'd love to see if you like the show, give us a rating and review on whatever platform you listen to it on. We appreciate that. All right. I know that I speak for both of my co-hosts, both Tim and Mo, when I say no matter how qualitative the data is, no matter your engagement level, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. Let's keep the conversation going with your comments, suggestions, and questions on Twitter at Analytics Hour, on the web at analyticshour.io, our LinkedIn group, and the Measure Chat Slack group. Music for the podcast by Josh Crowhurst.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Analytics. Oh my God. What the fuck does that even mean?
Oh, well, I guess I will throw in. There's also a thing that I will yell out at the end that is, it'll be rock flag and something, which is just a goofy thing that goes at the
end. You're going to start telling guests that and not shocking them?
You guys, I thought I was forbidden to tell guests that.
I'm totally okay.
You're fine to tell guests.
No, I think it's fine. I like how awkward it is.
It doesn't change the experience one way or the other.
This is what it's like working for this show, getting conflicting information from this.
Poor Andrew is like, what the hell have I signed up for here?
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like, could we just do the podcast?
Interestingly, our survey actually is like, ugh, it's the bane of my existence because, yes, I believe in like privacy and obfuscating the user, but basically, there is no way that you can look at any row-level data, even totally anonymized, because they're like, basically, if we had a couple of different questions stitched together, someone might be able to hypothetically figure out who it was, which would still be quite tricky. And so therefore, like, you can't actually pull all of the data out, and it kills me. Kills me.
Because you really want to know exactly who said exactly what. Deep down?
No, because I want to be able to look at relationships between different questions, which you can't do.
Oh, no. I was just trying to goad you into saying something on while we were still recording. That
no, I'm not I would be able never to... fall for that, Tim. Okay.
Rock flag and fill out your employee survey.